Hi, it's Garen with Shamrock Roofing and Construction. Need a new roof fast? Consider Shamrock Roofing and Construction. Our rapid repair team will get you a quote within 24 hours and will always repair before we replace. One call does it all. ShamrockRoofer.com.
The show that takes you home. The Home Stretch with Sterling Holmes on ESPN Kansas City. 1510 AM, 94.5 FM, and the ESPN Kansas City Facebook page.
Welcome to the Home Stretch here, ESPN Kansas City. 1510 AM, 94.5 FM, 1510.com, and Facebook Live. Live in studio on this beautiful hump day. Last night was scary, though. Last night was not fun. Beards is joining me behind the glass. We'll have Jordan Foote on from Arrowhead Report inside the Royals and Crashing Hoops in just a second. But yeah, last night was not fun, okay? The tornado supposedly came down at like 95th and Metcalf. Beards, I live at 88th and Antioch. That's close.
A little too close for comfort there?
That's the jack stack that I go to. I was not happy. I was in my sub-basement where the laundry machine was, me and my girlfriend and my dog. You know why you don't throw away old chairs? For moments just like that. I have my grandpa's old rocking chair that's just falling apart, but I had a place to sit. That's why you become a hoarder. If you become a hoarder and you throw it downstairs, you'll be prepared for tornadoes. That's what I learned. Jordan Foote now joining us on the home stretch. Again, Jordan Foote from Arrowhead Report. Inside the Royals and Crashing Hoops. We're going to talk Chiefs. We're going to talk Royals, maybe. And we'll talk some NBA. Jordan, how you doing?
Good, buddy. As we speak, the Royals are up 6-3 on the Toronto Blue Jays. So, I mean, I'm not trying to jinx them or anything, but not only have they scored one run in this series, but they've dropped six of them. They might be able to avoid the sweep.
Wow. So you're saying the Royals are fixed. Don't fire anyone.
Pretty much. I mean, like, if you would run that through, that's pretty much exactly what I said if you ran back the tape, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. It was the Royals are fine. This was the game that, you know what, they could be 17-37, but they're fine. They're going to go on a 37-17 run and get back to 500.
Yeah, and then they're going to, you know, go on a magical World Series run. They're going to face the Giants and kind of avenge their defeat at the hands of them, and Madison Bumgarner will somehow be there again, and Joe Buck will, for some reason, be calling. I mean, the whole thing, it'll just repeat itself.
Dude, let's just start with the Royals so we can get the ugly out of the way early. First off, are you surprised Cal Eldred is still here? Are you surprised that Dayton Moore isn't on just the hottest seat, hotter than the sun? Are you surprised that not as many people, I mean, I'm not technically on this train, but are you surprised that maybe Mike Matheny's seat is not as hot as it probably should be? Or has just apathy set in throughout the majority of the fan base?
I think apathy has set in for a lot of people, media, fans, even maybe people within the organization, I think, a little bit. The Royals, man, this is kind of their forte. Like, they're going to be loyal to a fault. They're going to stick with their guys for better or worse. They're going to keep repeating processes, whether they work or not. They're going to keep putting the same people in the same positions, whether it works or not. The accountability thing, it's almost, I guess it is comical, that they will preach accountability and preach being competitive and preach, you know, having those core values of wanting to not tank and not call it a rebuild and all that stuff, then that's exactly what they do. I mean, this is kind of what the Royals' MO is right now. It's what they're known as. It's what they're getting made fun of as, both locally and nationally. There was an article, I think it was on The Athletic yesterday, ranking the managers who are on the hottest of seats. Mike Matheny was number one, and there was like a national component that some rival executives do think that this could be it for him pretty soon. Now, do I think the Royals are going to make a in-season change? It just doesn't seem like that, especially without knowing much about John Sherman. But, man, it's not surprising, but also probably equally as, like, puzzling. I think puzzling would probably be a better word for it.
I mean, just to me, sure, Mike Matheny deserves some blame. I mean, he is the dude who keeps rolling out Carlos Santana, who, by the way, is 2-for-2 today, and also walked, so on base 3 times. No, but Matheny's only given these guys.
Yeah.
He's not the dude who is drafting Singer, Bubich, Coar, all the guys who have come up and imploded, right? He's not the guy drafting these guys. He's not the guy who is not getting any sort of pitching development. That kind of falls on Cal Eldred, you know, guys not becoming ready or not ready once they get to the majors who have dominated in, you know, previous stops. To me, this is more on Dayton Moore. I don't want to blame Mike Matheny because Mike Matheny, this is what he's given. The fact that Whit Merrifield was supposed to be one of your best players and he has a OPS of what, 550? Like, that's not on Mike Matheny. He can't do anything. Salvi hit, what was it, 48, 49 home runs last year, and he has an OPS of under 600. What is he supposed to do? This is not on Matheny, at least in my estimation. I think we need to talk more about Dayton Moore and his lack of, I would say, his lack of ownership to what has happened and transpired here.
Yeah, no, I agree wholeheartedly, and I think if Matheny didn't have the checkered history that he does, people wouldn't be talking about him at all as the scapegoat here, saying, you know, it's not all Mike Matheny's fault. He can only play with the cards that he's dealt. Could he be more proactive with getting Santana out of the lineup and not, you know, getting Ryan O'Hearn in it? Yeah, absolutely, sure. But you're only given so many players. I mean, he cannot call up Vinny Pasquantino. He cannot call up Nick Prado. He cannot DFA Carlos Santana. He cannot DFA Ryan O'Hearn. He kind of just does what he is told to do. He's done what he's trained to do. He's not blameless. Like, I'm not trying to say that he is good at his job or anything, but he's also not a train wreck like some people are saying. Mike Matheny's the main reason the Royals are bad. The Royals are bad because they've built a bad team and they make bad decisions to continue to build that bad team. They have people who are doing bad at their jobs at the highest level. Like, it's not hard to see why this team is so bad right now. With that said, no one thought Salvador Perez would be this bad. No one thought, well, few people thought Whit Merrifield would be this bad. Nicky Lopez the same way. So there are underperforming reasons that contribute to this. And, you know, Cal Eldred should be brought up as well. But at the crux of it, man, it's not Mike Matheny's fault totally. He's not blameless, but if you're making a list of reasons, it's got to include Dayton Moore above him. It's got to include Cal Eldred probably above him. Part of that, Matheny being loyal to him, I could see that argument. And a part of it's on the players, too. Like, he can't go out there and, like you said, make Whit Merrifield play better or make Salvador Perez play better. So I'm not trying to completely excuse or completely defend Mike Matheny, but I do think he is getting a little bit too much hate.
My Nicky Lopez is Chris Getz with a good eye prediction is
it's back.
I feel bad, but man, it's back. Anytime a dude's batting 217, slugging 257, and an on-base percentage of 294, yeah, you're going to get the Chris Getz treatment. Sorry, Nicky. It's not my fault. You know, maybe.
Brother, he just isn't it. He's 27 now. Like, he kind of is what he is, I think. He had a good game last year. Or not a good game, a good season last year. A bunch of good games. And I was, like, the guy that withheld judgment of Nicky Lopez. And, like, he's going to figure it out. And then he did for, whatever, two-thirds of the season. It hasn't clicked for him. He's been a tad bit better in stretches as of the past month or so. But, I mean, still, he's not producing. The power is never going to be there at all. He's not winning at his game, and that's worrisome. He kind of is based on batted ball luck, and maybe next year he does bounce back, but I'm not sure it's in a full role for the Royals. The Nicky Lopez can be penciled in as a starting middle infielder cannot be the thing anymore. I mean, you can't even write that in a erasable pen, I don't think. So it's a tough one, man. They have a lot of guys who aren't playing as well as they should. Still, the pitching is a complete and utter disaster. Mm-hmm. That's not helping. Ironically, they got rid of the pitching hitting coach well before they're going to end up getting rid of the pitching coach, I would assume. So, again, it's backwards, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. But because it's the Royals, that's also kind of par for the course.
Yeah. What's it going to take for Dayton Moore to get fired or for the Royals to move on from him? I know they had the whole J.J. Piccolo's now the GM. He's just an overseer. But I thought somewhere Dayton Moore had like 51% of the final say. So if he wants something, it's still Dayton Moore pulling the strings. Is this just going to have to come at some point from John Sherman saying, you know what, enough is enough? Do you think it could happen during the regular season? Or is this something that the Royals fans, they're just going to have to endure the 162-game brutal stretch that this is going to become?
Yeah, I do think it comes from John Sherman at the end of the year. If they lose 100-plus, which, I mean, it's kind of looking like that's going to happen right now. I do think, you know, they're going to have a talk, and there's going to have to be a clear plan with JJ and Dayton and whoever else about the future of the franchise. And maybe they're going to have that during the year, but I don't think – just not knowing a ton about what John Sherman's MO is going to be here in Kansas City or what his – he hasn't had a signature moment yet. His signature moment, the closest thing to it, is talking about building a downtown stadium. Like, he hasn't had the, I'm going to, you know, buck up and be the owner and put my foot down type thing. I think this offseason could be it. The Royals keep talking about this rebuild and how they don't want to call it a rebuild. They want to call it a retool or a whatever they want to call the alternate word, that they were going to compete this year. Clearly not going to happen. I don't think next year they're going to be anything better than a slightly competitive, slightly bad team. So you're looking at 2024 before this team has a realistic shot at the postseason. Teams nowadays are taking 3 years to rebuild and be back. The Royals are in year 5, year 6 of this thing. So it's not looking great. I think John Sherman does put his foot down at some point, but I also do think they're going to have to sit through. Fans will have to wait the whole season before something like that happens.
If you want a downtown stadium, you have to put your foot down. You can't just let this continue. Because if you have more fans just say, screw this, good luck getting that stadium. Good luck. Anyone on the fence, just to spite it. You know what I'm saying? Just because out of spite, you're not going to do anything. Because you're like, you know what? No, screw that. If you're going to put out a product like this, if you don't take it seriously, if you're just going to try and take money from fans without actually trying to put a good product on the field, no, I'm not going to back you. Before we move on, just one last talk about this. Why can't the Royals get a guy like Shane McClanahan or Logan Gilbert? This, again, obviously comes down to Dayton Moore. It comes down to scouting, or it comes down to development. But it just feels like the Royals never get that guy. I mean, Bobby Witt Jr., he's been fine, right? He's a rookie. He's going to have stretches where he struggles. He has stretches where he looks really, really good. I know not everyone's going to come up as a rookie and just dominate. But if you're looking at the, 2018 first-round picks, it's not like everyone has came up and dominated, right? Casey Mize has shown flashes. You could probably say Brady Singer's in the same boat as Casey Mize at this point. But Shane McClanahan, looking like a Cy Young candidate, Logan Gilbert, who has been really, really good for most of this season, and then you look around, you're like, okay, Chris Bubich can't stay up here. Jackson Coar can't stay up here. Brady Singer is finally starting to learn how to throw a third pitch, but even today, this is about what he is, 5 innings, 3 runs. Why can't the Royals ever find these guys?
Part of it is the scouting problem with Goldberg and Moore and whoever else they have, you know, in that system. I'm not trying to blame it all on them. Part of it is development, I think. Like, you can scout guys all you want, but you can also ruin a really good player if your development sucks, and you can also get a middling prospect or a decent prospect, and that's going to max them out if your development sucks. So, I mean, I know the Royals are kind of redoing. They redid the hitting element of the minor league system. It saw huge dividends. They need to, ironically and kind of unsurprisingly, do something similar at the big league level with those guys and say, we need new coaching, we need new philosophies. You see even guys who are well-established, the Jake Junises of the world, going on and figuring it out with other teams. It just isn't a good look for the Royals. They are not known for homegrown developmental. They caught lightning in a bottle when Eric Hosmer came up, Mike Moustakas came up, Escobar was growing after the trade. Kane came of age. He was a little bit older than those guys. But still, all those guys, then they made a couple savvy moves and got to the World Series. It's not like they had 5 homegrown pitchers who were dominant. You know, the bullpen was great. But even Wade Davis was part of that trade package. The Royals just didn't have a ton. They don't have the reputation now. They didn't have it back then. And you're kind of seeing the results. It's been, 16 years under Dayton Moore, and I think the only way for that to change, part of it's luck, getting good players, but part of it is being able to produce good players, even if you don't find the diamond in the rough in the draft.
I mean, sorry to beat a dead horse, but it's also like the Astros. They were horrible for a long time, and they just completely redid everything. They got all those high draft picks, and they made it work for an extended period of time. Ever since those dark days when the Astros were just the worst team in baseball, they acquired those top draft picks. They missed on some. If you look back, they didn't hit on every single draft pick, because you're not going to hit on every single draft pick. No. But they hit on a few, and they were able to build and build for the future and build in the long run. What frustrates me is the Royals would never give a guy like Jordan Alvarez a chance. You know why?
Nope.
He's not toolsy enough. He's not athletic enough. Well, guess what? He's got a six-year, what, $115 million contract extension, whatever it was, an obscene amount of money. Because you know why? The dude absolutely rakes. Same thing with Frank Schwindel. They traded him to the Cubs. They got rid of him because they go, well, we can't find room for him, but we can keep Ryan O'Hearn because he's toolsy. He is more athletic. I don't care. I want a dude who's good at baseball. Look at Miguel Cabrera. He's not the pinnacle of health. Billy Butler was one of the best hitters on this Royals team for a long time. He was not the pinnacle of health. Like, his nickname was Country Breakfast. They don't have to be Michael A. Taylor athletic. I just get so frustrated. They like, well, if he's not 6'4 and just yoked, well, he can't play on this team. Who cares? Okay? I just get, sorry, Jordan, okay? We'll move on. Let's talk Chiefs before I have an aneurysm over here. Jordan Foote is joining us from Arrowhead Report into the Royals and Crashing Hoops right here on the home stretch. Really quickly with the Tyreek Hill podcast stuff, do you have any thoughts regarding this?
I respect them for doing it. As a fellow media person who likes getting engagement, I respect that out of his team and the perfect cutoff between, well, are they suppressing your stats? And then the, well, and then cutting it off. Like, I think that was genius. I also think it was dumb. But I mean, that's the double-edged sword with media. You have to get those types of things out there because then people like us will share and talk about it.
Yeah.
Then obviously he came back for his camp, said that it was no big deal. I kind of expected that, but the shock value initially was, wow, this guy really will not stop talking about the Chiefs. In reality, the co-host or producer or whatever just asked a really bad question. Then it cut off, leading everyone to think that there was something more to it. So, I mean, there's not much to be said, but there's also just enough to where Tyreek and his team kind of succeeded in their goal.
Yeah, he came out and was saying, you know, I got people's panties in a bunch, and that's what he wanted to do is what he said. It's like, I guess, I'm just over it. Tyreek Hill's no longer in Kansas City, and I'm annoyed that we have to keep talking about it. Like, I'm already sad enough that he's no longer Kansas City Chief. Obviously, what transpired post the trade with the draft picks and who Kansas City was able to acquire, the contract that Tyreek Hill signed, I'm okay. I've accepted it. I think it was probably the right move for the long run. But it's still like, he's no longer a Chief. I don't want to keep talking about him down there with Tua Tagovailoa throwing him the ball, okay? We're going to move on from this. So this is me, Jordan, saying I'm moving on from talking about Tyreek Hill.
All right, I'm going to hold you to that, Sterling.
Okay, so Tyreek Hill, no. As far as the defense goes for Kansas City, are you expecting a long, arduous, growing pain type of thing where it's two-thirds of the season? Not only does a typical Steve Spagnuolo defense take a while to gel, but there's so many new pieces, so many young guys. Do you think this could be a real struggle early on?
Yeah, I do think so, man. It's going to take a minute. It's not going to be – actually, I'm going to read off a tweet that a very wise person sent out. I think it was yesterday. Will the Chiefs defense struggle early on? Probably. There's a lot of youth there, but the athleticism and physicality will be noticeable. Second half of the season defensively should look completely different than the first half. Sterling, I'm guessing that you're mildly familiar with that tweet.
Is that me?
For those listening at home or in their vehicles. It was a very well thought out tweet, and that's exactly how I feel. Like, if you would have asked me without me knowing that tweet, I would have repeated something similar. The Chiefs defense built with veterans has taken half the season to get going before. It's taken 10 weeks or whatever. Now you're sending out guys who literally have never played in the NFL, let alone in that system. It's going to take a while, and maybe they adopt things quicker because there's the flip side of having knowledge. You're also a little more stubborn. Maybe these guys are able to be molded, and this is all they've ever known at the NFL level. Perhaps that works. Perhaps the athleticism helps cover up for a lack of fundamental understanding. Perhaps the physicality helps. On the flip side of it, it's going to take a while. There are going to be blown coverages. There are going to be growing pains. They also play a bunch of really, really good offenses. So people are wrapped up in the whole, well, if the Chiefs defense is 22nd or 23rd this season, it's a failure. I don't think so. Well, look at it after 10 weeks or look at the progress, look at the tape. I'm not going to get too caught up in the numbers on the defensive side this year for the Chiefs. Lots of moving pieces, lots of young guys. It's going to look different. It's going to take a while, but I think ultimately they're going to be fine.
Yeah, it's going to take a while, and I think it's going to be a lot of yelling at the TV early on in the season, but I do think that there's also going to be some situations early on where you see Leo Chanel or Willie Gay Jr. or Nick Bolton on a third down not getting ripped off the field for Ben Neiman. We're like, wow, this is fun. This is so much more physical. That's a play that, let's say, Dan Sorensen wasn't going to make. Say Brian Cook, right? Say he has a huge stop. And you're like, wow, where was that athleticism last year? Where was that putting your nose in there last year? Maybe George K makes a good play. I just think this team is so much more athletic that even with the, like you mentioned, just the youth, the lack of experience, I do think at times it could play in their favor, not for early on, but just as it goes on, the season. There's going to be plays that you're just going to sit back and say, wow, this is fun.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I'm not trying to slander this player or these two players or anything. I'm not trying to throw them all the way on.
Yes, you are, Jordan. Don't lie.
I kind of am trying to phrase it as best I can, but like Tyrann Mathieu and Anthony Hitchens last year, Hitchens was hurt for part of the year. Mathieu was hurt for part of the year. They were also making business decisions, man. Yeah. They knew they were in essentially contract seasons. Hitchens knew he probably wasn't coming back. Mathieu knew he definitely wasn't coming back. Those guys are trying to avoid getting hurt further. They're trying to preserve what they have left in their athleticism. They're trying to not make those huge hits. They're trying to not risk themselves. Like, it's one of those things where you bring in a young, athletic Justin Reed who's known for not giving it you-know-what. He's going to go out there and do whatever he wants. You have Nick Bolton, who clearly doesn't give a you-know-what. You have Leo Chanel, who doesn't. You have Willie Gay, who doesn't. Like, I'm not saying it's addition by subtraction, because Hitchens had good stretches in Kansas City, and Mathieu, obviously, one of the best safeties in the league during his time with the team. But, like you said, there are going to be times where just athleticism and a willingness and a hunger flat out beats the expertise or the experience or the wherewithal or the mental fortitude, whatever you want to call it. There are going to be plays where those guys simply couldn't have done what these guys are going to be able to do. And I think that's going to help the Chiefs. So, yes, there's going to be frustrating moments. Yes, Sterling is going to be screaming at his television. But in the end, they not only set themselves up long-term in a much better spot, both cap and roster-wise, I think, but they also are going to compete this year. Like, if things click, there's no reason to say the Chiefs couldn't make a Super Bowl run. Am I expecting it? Probably not, but I'm also not ruling that out.
Let's go there before we switch gears and go to the NBA. With this Chiefs schedule, it is absolutely brutal with a lot of new pieces, a lot of youth injected into this team. Where do you see them ending up? What's your record prediction? You don't have to give me like a game by game, but just a general overview. I know OTAs haven't even finished. Like, we don't even know who's going to be on the 53-man roster. For all we know, there could be a big trade still in the making. But just your initial, on June 8th, record prediction, what do you got?
Yeah, so I've been sticking with 11-6 throughout the offseason, ever since the day the schedule dropped. I think
Jordan,
they went 12-5 last year. If they take a one game drop off, considering all the moving pieces and the schedule, I think that's reasonable to expect. And I don't think that means that I'm down on the Chiefs. I also think the Chargers are going to be really good. I also think the Broncos are going to be at least competitive. I think the Raiders are going to be at least competitive. The AFC got better. Like, I think Buffalo will be the clear number one seed, I think, in the AFC. The Chiefs could be 5. They also could be like 2 or 3 or 4. I think they go 11-6. It comes down to either the Chargers going 12-5 or a tiebreaker between those two teams. So I'm not like predicting Chiefs wild card or Chiefs division champs because of the tiebreaker, but I think they go 11-6 this year.
Jordan, I don't like this because you and I agree. Okay, it's no fun. I wanted to argue with you.
I mean, I can say 9-8 if you want me to, or like 6-11, or I mean, I can lie.
No, I'm with you, Jordan. I had the Chiefs going 11-6 as well. I actually did say they're going to have the tiebreaker over the Chargers. That's how the Chiefs win the AFC West, because I think the Chargers go 11-6. I do think the Bills just basically run away with the one seed. Yep. I mean, let's be real here. That's a poor division, that AFC East. So the Bills have it. In my opinion, the Bills, that's their division to lose. They're probably the most excited about the upgrades happening in the AFC West, because, like, you know, finally the Chiefs have to go up against some brutal teams. The Russell Wilson addition for Denver makes them automatically a contender. I think maybe they win 9-10 games. The Raiders, it's so much fun to obviously rip on Derek Carr. By the end of the day, he is still an above-average quarterback. He's still probably a top-12 quarterback. They added Devontae Adams. That defensive line is extremely, extremely good. I mean, this is going to be different. If you are a Chiefs fan, it's not going to be like in the past where if they lose a game, you're sitting here like everything had to go wrong. I think this season is going to be one you almost forget, right? Before the Chiefs had this complete domination of the AFC West, you got to remember, there were some tough times. The Peyton Manning-led Broncos, before he decided to throw 6 interceptions, just fall apart. Like, the Broncos had the Chiefs' number, right? So I think it's going to go more to that, where each game comes down to the wire. It just comes down to, can the Chiefs hold on?
Well, and man, that's even without mentioning the rest of the teams in the AFC. Like, even a Cincinnati is obviously the reigning AFC champion. Mm. A team
they
like
missed the playoffs.
It's going to be better. A team, you think so?
Oh yeah, I am.
I think they go 10-7, so I'm leaning that they make it with that. But it's also 10-7 now might be the 10-6 of old. Or no, does that mean 11-6 is now the 10-6 of old, where every 5 or 6 years or whatever, a team that goes 10-6 misses it? Or if you're 10-7, do you feel pretty confident about getting in?
No, that's a really good point. And I think the AFC in general, there's going to be a lot of teams around that 10-6, 11-5, or I guess, no, 11-6, 10-7. Dude, this 17 game just throws with you. But I think there's going to be a lot of teams around that 10-win, 9-win, 11-win kind of rank. I don't know about your thoughts there, but that's where I think that it's really going to come down to, who do you beat?
Yes. Yeah, and even in the divisions, like, it's Baltimore, it's Cincinnati, it's Tennessee and Indianapolis that can compete for 9 or 10. I think New England could win, like, 9 games. Like, Miami, if things break right, they could win 9 or 10. Like, I don't expect some of those teams to do it, but you're looking at the AFC and you try to rule out, like, definitely playoff teams. You're like, the Jets almost surely won't make it. The Steelers almost surely won't make it. Who else can you throw out, really? Jacksonville and Houston, obviously, in the South. Other than that, man, there are going to be a lot of competitive teams, and some of that will sort itself out just because of math. But, man, I went through and did a simulation. I wish I had my standings right here. Salvador Perez just laced a triple, which is I'd like to know how many triples he has in his career. I think it'll be an equally rare occurrence that the AFC is just flat-out dominant as Salvador Perez triples in a baseball game.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, well, he is known for his wheels. There's one thing Salvi is known for. It's for triples. I mean,
yeah.
Salvador Triple-O. Remember that one? The old huddlerism for Paulo Orlando. Yeah.
Yeah, I tried to block that out of my memory, but now it's back forever, so thanks a lot.
Let's talk a little bit of NBA before we let you go, Jordan. The Golden State Warriors, they play Boston tonight in Boston. Series tied, won a game apiece. How do you think it plays out?
Man, I'm kind of torn. I picked the Dubs in 6 to win the series. I'm still rocking with that, even though Boston did steal game 1, which I didn't expect to happen. Like, I'm the series doesn't start until the road team wins type of guy. The road team won game 1. So I was like, well, I mean, the series has started now. I think the Dubs will take this one. I think Boston ties it up at 2. Then they kind of go from there, and I think the Dubs will begin to separate themselves. I just can't picture Boston losing back-to-back games at home. So, I mean, maybe they drop this one and then win the next one or vice versa. But Curry has been absolutely dominant. Or I guess he's been really, really, really good. I shouldn't say absolutely dominant. Klay's been terrible. Mm. Poole has had stretches. Wiggins has been good. Boston, I just don't trust their role players to keep doing this. Golden State defended them much, much, much better in game 2 They were running them off the three-point line, forcing them to make split-second decisions and pick and roll and really forcing them inside the arc. You're not going to get killed in the mid-range by Boston. You're going to get killed from deep, and you're going to get killed in transition. You're going to get killed around the basket. You can run them off the three-point line. Golden State has found something, I think, in Wiggins and Draymond, obviously, a long time ago. Looney has been good. Mm. Like, their defense is just good enough, I think, for where the offensive gap is bigger than it is between those two on defense. I know Beard isn't going to love me saying this, but I'm ever so slightly going to go Golden State in six over, ooh, I almost change it to Golden State in seven.
Wow. Yeah, I got Golden State in seven.
I like Boston. I like Boston. Don't get me wrong. Like, I've talked to Beards. I'm a big Jason Tatum fan. Jaylen Brown's the truth. Robert Williams, one of my favorite players. Horford is cool. Derek White's great.
I hate Al Horford as a Sixers fan. Can't stand him.
I used to hate Al Horford so much. And like, the guy,
I like him, man. He seems like a great dude. But like,
he's such a great dude.
What he did to the Sixers, signed that massive contract, was horrible. Before then, he was the Embiid stopper. And then all of a sudden, he
and
leaves.
Simmons. Embiid and Simmons. He guarded them both.
It's just, and he shoots like an old man at the YMCA who shows up at 6 a.m. on a Sunday run. You know what I'm talking about? You're like, I don't know if
he shouldn't be good.
Yeah, he shouldn't be good. And then he blew by Giannis Antetokounmpo last series. And you're like, okay.
And he was getting DMPs in Oklahoma City. Like, he was literally, they deemed him unplayable and did not want him out there. A, because they were tanking, they didn't want to say it. But also, because he wasn't good. And now he just found the fountain of youth and it couldn't be a nicer guy. Like, I do. I used to hate Al Horford. I am now full circle on him. But like I said, Boston could definitely win the series. Golden State's been there before. Steph needs a finals MVP. Klay won't be this bad all series. The role players keep stepping up. I just think the Dubs have a little bit more.
Hey, Jordan, I have one stat for you that I want to see if that changes your mind about tonight. Since January 23rd, Boston has not lost back-to-back games except for once, and that was only because they sat every starter except Marcus Smart against Toronto in the regular
season. That's almost as crazy as the stat before the last game, obviously, that every time Tatum had less than 20 in, like, a playoff game, he came back and had 37 or more every single time. Like, Boston, man, and their defense has been so good, and I think, like, Time Lord's a little bit banged up and it's hurting them. But they could win tonight. Like, I have absolutely, like, 5% confidence in this series. And then if you ask me again after tonight and Boston wins, I might just switch the picks. So I'm very indecisive about this series as a whole.
We're going to take a break. But before we go, Jordan, when was the last time Salvador Perez had a triple? Beards found the year. Beards found it for us.
It was on the broadcast.
It was in 2017.
Okay, did you look that up?
I did not.
That was impressive. Jordan, you should go gamble. You should go to the casino, throw all your money down. You got
to
do it, Jordan. Come on.
I have to prep for Kansas somehow, you know.
Jordan Foote from Arrowhead Report, Inside the Royals, and Crashing Hoops. You can follow him on Twitter, @FootNoted. Jordan, always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
And we'll take a quick break. The home stretch here, ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back to the home stretch here, ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM, 94.5 FM, 1510.com, and Facebook Live. Thank you again to Jordan Foote joining us on here. Beards, I'm digging this. This is what Scott Foster needs to come out to tonight.
Please, no.
Come on. Can't you just picture Scott Foster?
Oh, I can. That's the problem.
Dancing in the locker room, just getting ready. You know, he's just vibing to this right here, working on his tees, working on how he's going to tease somebody. Because you know he's throwing at least one tee out tonight. Like, that's a lock. If you're in Vegas, it's got to be 1.5, right? Got to be 1.5.
Let's see if there are actually odds on that. See if I can find that.
You find odds. We're going to talk NBA for about the rest of the show today because I have Beards here with me, and Beards likes the NBA, and frankly, I like the NBA, and they're playing for the one time this week.
They play it on Friday, don't they?
They do. I'm more or less making a joke the fact that they somehow need three games off the majority of the time.
Listen,
it's so annoying.
No, I'm okay with it because the last couple rounds were every other day.
And it was awesome to watch.
Yeah, but you could tell it was taking a physical toll on everybody.
Okay, I get it, but they might be these athletes who are just physical freaks playing sports, but I, Sterling, need to drink a beer and watch a sporting event. And the Royals are horrible, so I need more NBA.
That's understandable.
The Royals were good. I would say take your time. The Royals being bad, it's like, no, I need the NBA. I need this more often than on once or twice a week.
I'm not seeing any prop bets, at least in the kind that we're looking for. A lot of it's just like, who has more assists? Who has more points and rebounds combined?
How many technical fouls does Scott Foster give out?
You know, that's not here, and that's the issue that I have.
Does he somehow still try and find Chris Paul to give him a little T?
Yes.
That's the best. The little T just cracks me up. Nothing will ever beat that. Do you actually think he sits in front of a mirror? Like working
in practices?
Yes. Just coming out, just vibing, and just... How many times has he yelled, Scott Foster time, baby?
That one I have less confidence in.
I feel like I have more confidence in him saying, just walking around, looking in a mirror going, it's Scott Foster time, baby. That's what I picture him doing. Who gets a tech first, Marcus Smart or Draymond Green? Or is it going to be one of those rare double techs? Same time. He points to both of them.
I don't know. It feels like a good double tech game from somebody.
I'm telling you, if I had the over-under set at 1.5 techs given out, I'm taking the over. Draymond, after last game where he was playing bully ball, and you know me, Beards, not a Celtics guy at all. I'm a Sixers fan, and before I was a... Because I worked for the Sixers, if you guys don't know. I obviously am a Sixers fan now. I used to like the Lakers before then. My dad used to live in L.A. Obviously, no one was a Clippers fan, although Katina Mobley was pretty cool, and Corey Maggette. And Chris Kaman and Elm Brand.
Corey,
yeah, those teams.
McGinnis.
Yeah. But that's besides the point. So I don't like Boston, okay? Not my team. Not a Celtics guy. Celtics got a little bit screwed, I want to say. I don't think it affected the game that much because when you lose by, what did they lose by? 15?
I have the score here.
It was like 107-88, something like that.
It was exactly 107-88.
Boom, nailed it. Refing's not going to make that many points up in that scenario. But Draymond Green was playing football. I don't know if you saw that one where he took out three guys on a moving screen.
It wasn't a moving screen. It was a push. It was a literal just two hands forward. Like, what's the football drill? The sled?
Yeah,
that's what it was. It was he took three guys and just shoved them back and gave Steph Curry a three.
He looked like Anthony Sherman.
And then he was hooking Marcus Smart a couple other times as well on moving screens. Yeah.
Steph on a pull-up three. He just elbowed, was it Tatum, out of the way?
I don't remember.
And then pulled up?
At least I don't think I saw that one.
I was watching it, and I'm just sitting here and go, first off, Tatum didn't complain. I understand that maybe he shouldn't have gone that far back because it's Steph Curry, and he's Jason Tatum, big size differential. Still an offensive foul.
Yes.
Multiple times throughout that game, it was mostly with Draymond Green. He was getting into it with Jaylen Brown on the ground. Draymond Green does this. This is who he is. He's a instigator. I saw on ESPN, ESPN.com, they called him annoying. How often do major publications call an NBA athlete or just any athlete in any sport in general annoying?
They called Draymond annoying?
They called Draymond annoying in words.
I mean,
it was like a
be.
Front page article. It's just, this is who Draymond Green is. This is what he wants to do. I have no problem with it. If I had to pick a team that I like more, I'm going with the Warriors just because I am a Sixers fan. But I want to see a fairly called game, right? I don't want to see Draymond Green for 37 minutes out there running into dudes. That's not basketball.
No, it's not ideal.
I know people who are fans of the 90s. Don't get me wrong. I love 90s basketball. But part of the reason they did that, they weren't as good as now. There were different scenarios, different things going on. I don't need to see Charles Oakley in the NBA Finals right now in 2022. Marcus Smart is someone who has changed his game completely, right? Would you agree, Beards, of almost any player in the NBA, a guy who came in as almost that Draymond Green type of, I'm going to get in your head, I'm going to be physical, I'm going to be a menace. But Marcus Smart also learned how to get a jump shot. He learned how to be an actual point guard.
That's the big thing for this year, because I think the last time I was on, we kind of talked about this a little bit. He always was the secondary ball handler on all of these teams that he's played for, whether it was with Isaiah Thomas or Kyrie or Kemba Walker. He was always the two, like, the quote-unquote two guard there. And this year he was asked to be the full-time point guard. And it was a rough start to the year, and he, I don't know if it was everybody sat down and told him, hey, you need to calm down a little bit and be more of a facilitator, if that was something he did on his own. But he really improved in the second half of the year,
yeah,
and became a real point guard and not a guy that does the no good shot 90% of the time.
But his progression, at least to me, since he's gotten to the NBA, has been noticeable. Because he had no jump shot. He gained a jump shot.
He gained a semblance of a jump shot. It's still not like perfect.
No, he's not Steph Curry. But my point was, he was throwing up bricks when he first came in. Every time he shot, if it was a wide open three, you're still
That's
saying
fair, yeah.
No. Now, I think he's a fine shooter. To me, this series all comes down to secondary pieces. I think while Steph is better than Jason Tatum, they're both your one and one, right?
Sure.
Then it comes down to your Jaylen Brown, who I think is probably this point, because Klay Thompson is not what he once was.
Jaylen would be like, next on that list.
I would say Jaylen Brown is third.
If you're doing this draft-wise, Jaylen probably be third.
But then it comes down to, I think, Andrew Wiggins. The way he's played, he's going to get thrown in there. Jordan Poole, while he's not necessarily the most consistent player, at times he can take over when he is that sixth man type of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Kevon Looney has been incredible.
Ever since like the second half of the Memphis series. Yeah.
And honestly, as good as Al Horford was in game one, right? He was that bad in game two. Al Horford and Kevon Looney, they need to start canceling each other out. Just to me, this series comes down to the secondary pieces. I don't know about you, but I just don't see Jason Tatum or Steph Curry being that much better than the other, that they almost change a game. To me, it almost comes down to, does Wiggins have a good game? Does Derek White?
Yeah, Derek White.
Does he have six or seven threes? That's to me what it almost comes down to.
I'll pivot off that just like an itty bitty little bit, and kind of expand it a little bit. It's more, does Boston keep control of the ball, or do they do nothing but do live ball turnovers all game?
Yeah.
Because they were pretty good about that in game one, and they whooped the Warriors' butts. And then in game two, Gary Payton played.
Mm.
Draymond Green was guarding Jaylen Brown for a little bit, getting in their heads, and it became just a live ball turnover fest. And then that's how Boston's lost a lot of their games, is they just can't keep ahead of the ball. Like in the last series against Miami, and I think it was game three, where they just had a ton of turnovers, lost that game at home. So,
to me, this is a fun series in the fact that it is so team-based for both teams, right? I know Steph Curry has a lot of his one-on-one shots. I know Jason Tatum thrives in the one-on-one situations when he does that one dribble to the right, pull up. Almost, mm-hmm. It's an iteration of the James Harden, but without traveling.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, these two teams are teams. It's not just two or three superstars, and you have a whole bunch of guys thrown around them that are just almost G-leaguers. This is fun. It's good basketball, and they're both pretty good defensive teams, I would say.
I think they're 1-2 this postseason in terms of team defense. They might be that way in terms of the regular season as well.
Do you think the NBA is trending towards this, where it's more, you don't have to have three superstars, where it's you don't have to buy superstars? Both these two teams, for the most part, have been drafted. You could say Andrew Wiggins obviously was a trade, but the Warriors have gotten the best out of Andrew Wiggins, right?
Mm-hmm.
Celtics, for the most part, are homegrown. For the most part. Al Horford, sure. Those were some trades, but he's been there a few times now. Do you think that this is the way the NBA is going, or is this more of a one-off? Because the only other thing I'll say is the Milwaukee Bucks were homegrown for the most part with Giannis. They built around him. That's only a one superstar team.
Sure, but you'll still have teams like Miami, who's Jimmy Butler,
sure,
and Kyle Lowry, and you'll still have
Bam Adebayo,
the Clippers. Like, this will always happen. It's just that this year, the two teams that are there at the end are the ones that have been built from the ground up for the most part. I remember a couple years ago after Warriors-Raptors when Toronto won, Joshua Briscoe, we know that guy, was trying to make the case that the run of the superstar era was over and everybody was going to do it the way the Raptors did, where it's, you know, one A option and then just a bunch of Bs around there. And I was like, no, they're still going to have the arms race. Like, I think it'll still be an arms race because that's what everybody wants, is insurance for if one star goes down, we've still got the other one. One star goes down, we still have two other ones, and like Brooklyn's case last year. I just think that's, you know, Golden State and Boston have just survived better than everybody else this year.
Game three is going to be massive. If you look throughout history, the previous 39 teams that have split the first two games of the NBA Finals, the winner of Game three has gone on to win the series 82.1% of the time. So if you win Game three, over 80% of the time, you're winning the game. You're winning the series.
Mm-hmm.
Boston has a big advantage here. They're at home. Do they get it done?
I'd like to think so, because like we said with Jordan.
No, I know you'd like to think so.
I'd like to think so.
Where's your confidence? You're a Boston fan, so don't let it 55, get over you. 55?
55%.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the Warriors are excellent, and they have a defense that gives Boston problems with the way that they turn the ball over. I think Boston's defense matches up well with Golden State's offense. It's just Boston's offensive issues are highlighted by the Warriors' defense more.
Mm. I just saw something before we go to break. Forgot Nick Stauskas is a Boston Celtic.
Yeah, he is. Poor Vivek just crying over there that he doesn't have Stauskas anymore.
What was his nickname, Hot Sauce?
Oh, let's see.
Sauce Castillo.
Yes, that Sauce was Castillo. It. That was it. Wasn't he a Sixer at one point?
Oh, yeah, he was a Sixer. He was about the best Sixer for a while.
Ugh.
Yeah.
He was there for a couple years.
Oh, yeah, he sure was. That's when I was there. Sixers weren't very good.
No. No, they weren't.
So you can't say I'm a bandwagon guy because they weren't very good. They had Nick Stauskas and Isaiah Cannon.
I remember Isaiah Cannon.
Yeah. We'll take a quick break. Come back. The home stretch here, ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back to the home stretch here, ESPN Kansas City. Finish up with a little NBA talk again with Beards. So Pat Riley's 77, team president of the Miami Heat, and he's coming back. He did it by challenging a reporter to a push-up contest, saying, I'm 77 years old right now, and I can do more push-ups than you can do. If you want to go to the mat, let's go. That's awesome. Good for Pat Riley.
Kyle Lowry needs to do some push-ups.
Kyle Lowry he's gotten thick, man.
He's always been thick.
Yeah, but he's gotten sturdier. Like, he's gotten sturdy.
That's
yeah.
fair.
Him and James Harden probably have the same workout routine.
Wings?
Wings.
Wings are good. I can't knock it.
All right. What do you have? Celtics, Warriors, and in how many?
I originally said Celtics in seven. I'm going to keep with that.
I thought you were going to expand on that. No. It sounded like you had more.
I thought about it, but I was like, nah, I'm good.
Okay.
Celtics in seven, I'll stick with it.
I have Warriors in seven. What are you putting on it? We putting Canes on this?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Warriors in seven. You got season seven. We got Canes on this. Chicken is on the line. This was the home stretch here, ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM, 94.5 FM, 1510.com and Facebook Live. Thank you to Jordan Foote. Thank you to Beards McFly helping out over here. We'll be back live in studio tomorrow from 3 to 4 p.m. David Leske will join us. We'll talk some Royals. Yikes. We are out.